listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
He had a longtime fear of being poisoned.
Although there hasn't been a mad dash of psychiatrists and psychologists, with a snap diagnosis of obsessive-compulsive behavior, failed Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton was at the Grammys poking fun at President Trump.
One reason why he liked to eat at McDonald's. Nobody knew he was coming, and the food was safely pre-made.
Clinton was one of a number of people who were reading from a book about President Trump that's gained notoriety lately. But the selection of material for the former First Lady, Senator, Secretary of State, and twice-failed presidential candidate seemed ironic, to say the least, given her husband's well-known penchant for fast food.
All right, boys. Let's stop in here for a second. I'm a little parched from the jog.
Sir, we've only been jogging for 3 blocks. Besides, Mrs. Clinton asked us not to let you into any more fast food places.
Jim, let me tell you something. There's going to be a whole bunch of things we don't tell Mrs. Clinton.
It appears that some secrets are about to come out. The so-called memo, this was from a press conference held on Tuesday by Speaker of the House, Republican Paul Ryan.
Why is it okay for Republicans in the House to release a Republican memo and not at the same time as a Democratic memo to give the American public a full picture, or at least both sides of the argument behind this underlying intelligence?
Mano, what's okay is to follow the process as the process is laid out, and that's precisely what is happening. I would remind you that the Democrats tried blocking the rest of the members of Congress from even having access to the memo that the majority wrote. Yesterday, the majority voted to provide access to the Democrats' memo. The process is this. It's an 11G process. You've all probably reported on it, which is a memo gets released to the broader members. They read it. Then you go and scrub to make sure that no sources and methods are being compromised. And then you go through the process of releasing it. The majority's memo already went through that process. That process is underway. This memo that we just got popped on us yesterday is now going through that process. And I would just tell you, unlike the Democrats on the Intelligence Committee, who voted to deny access to this memo to the broader members, Republicans supported doing so.
Devin,
and so now, Devin actually made the motion. So now it will go through that 11G process just like this other memo did. And let me just say a few things. What's that? The chairman went to the FBI to go through the memo to make sure that we were protecting any sources and methods, and we are confident that we are. None of that work has been done on this new memo that no one has yet read, but the Republicans voted to allow the rest of the members to read it so that it can go through that process.
But why not hold back?
You've asked enough.
Why not ask the Republicans to wait and release their report at the same time as Democrats release theirs to overcome?
We're going to go through the process as the process is laid out, and it's ironic that the majority voted to actually give access to this memo while the minority voted to deny that access. So I think the irony is a little rich here these days. Casey.
Mr. Speaker, based on what you've learned from this memo, do you believe that the FBI and the DOJ used their power in a partisan way?
Yeah, let me make 4 points here. I think there are, as we think about all of this, I actually wrote some of this down. First, there are legitimate questions about whether an American's civil liberties were violated by the FISA process. We are the legislative branch of government. It is our job to conduct oversight on behalf of the American people of the executive branch in case any powers were abused and civil liberties were abused by the executive branch. So there's a very legitimate issue here as to whether or not an American's civil liberties were violated in the FISA process. That's point number one. Point number two. This is a completely separate matter from Bob Mueller's investigation, and his investigation should be allowed to take its course. Point number three, there may have been malfeasance by people at the FBI. And let me finish my points. There may have been malfeasance at the FBI by certain individuals. So it is our job in conducting transparent oversight of the executive branch to get to the bottom of that. Sunshine is the best disinfectant. And so what we want is all of this information to come out so that transparency can reign supreme and accountability can occur. There's a fourth point I want to make, and that is the institution of the DOJ, of the FBI, is a very important institution for American life. It's a very important institution for keeping the rule of law intact. The men and women, the vast number of the men and women over at DOJ, over at FBI, are professionals doing their jobs and doing their jobs well. The people over in the field office in Milwaukee, at the FBI office, are helping keeping heroin and opioids out of our schools. So we want the people of the FBI to know that we respect their job, we respect who they are and what they do, and all the more reason why we need to have transparency and accountability to hold people accountable if they violated the rules, if they acted in a wrong, improper way. And that is what we are doing here.
All the other conclusions that are being drawn by this investigation in the House are being held until the end. Why is it important to get this conclusion?
It would have been great to have all the documents that we requested months ago, but we did not. So as you know, the Congress has been asking for all of these documents from the executive branch so that we can do the executive branch oversight. It's the inspector general who just told us a couple of days ago they all of a sudden found the 5,000 text messages that were lost. So it would be nice if all of this information that Congress had requested would have been delivered when we asked for this stuff last August. So we had not been getting the information until fairly recently. That is why this is taking so long.
Last question.
Juan.
There's been some reporting that the president wants to fire Deputy AG Rod Rosenstein. Do you think that would be a wise decision?
I think Rod Rosenstein is doing a fine job. I have no reason to see why he should do that. Rosenstein was hired after this last election. I think the people at the FBI, at the DOJ, need to clean their own house if there are problems in their own house, and I think that's really important. And just, he came in after this last election.
Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan at a press conference Tuesday morning. Monday's daily press conference at the White House had this surprise.
Over the weekend, the White House released a framework for responsible immigration reform that will protect our people, put the interests of American workers first, and provide a permanent solution to DACA. Our framework includes four pillars: border security, including the wall, DACA legalization, ending extended family chain migration, and eliminating the visa lottery, moving us toward a merit-based system of immigration. We look forward to working with Congress to pass and sign legislation that addresses each of these four pillars.
RT's Caleb Maupin takes a look at what this could mean.
Amnesty for 1.8 million people who entered the United States illegally. That's what Donald Trump has just agreed to. Not exactly a hardline conservative policy. Doesn't really fit what we're used to hearing about the Donald.
I think the president might be racist.
President Trump's racist comments.
Inflammatory racist language.
The situation that we're used to has been completely reversed. At this point, the guys at the right-wing outlet known as Breitbart are furious with Trump. Now, Trump's image is loud, brash, and tough. You think he'd never apologize for anything. But he recently did apologize for making tweets that were offensive to Muslims.
I would certainly apologize if you'd like me to do that. I know nothing about them.
It's been over a year, and Trump is starting to look a little bit liberal. A lot of the right wing are disappointed, and some of the left wing doomsayers are looking a little bit silly.
You're not having a terrible, terrible dream.
Is there going to be remnants of a neo-fascist movement that he leads in this country after this election?
This guy is a complete clown.
Remember Steve Bannon, that scary far right winger who was supposedly directing Donald Trump behind the scenes? Yeah, he is not on good terms with the White House these days.
I think the president's statement is extremely clear what his position on Mr. Bannon is. It was pretty lengthy and pretty detailed, and there's not really much to clarify or to add. And if that's in reference to comments made by Mr. Bannon, I'd refer you back to the ones that he made previously on 60 Minutes, where he called the collusion with Russia about this president a total farce.
That report from RT's Caleb Maupin. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson played host to the foreign and defense ministers of Qatar. Tillerson was joined by Defense Secretary General James Mattis and their Qatari counterparts from the Al-Thani family at a press conference in Washington Tuesday.
Well, good morning, all. And the United States is very pleased to host this inaugural U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue. I want to welcome Foreign Minister Al-Thani, Minister of Defense Al-Attiya, and the entire Qatari delegation to Washington. And I want to express my thanks and appreciation to Secretary Mattis for joining us for this dialogue as well. Qatar is a strong partner and a longtime friend of the United States. We value the U.S.-Qatar relationship and hope the talks today deepen our strategic ties. In today's strategic dialogue sessions, we will discuss important areas of cooperation, including trade and investment, security, counterterrorism, energy, and aviation. The United States believes enhanced trade will contribute positively to both our country's economic development and create jobs for the American people and Qatari citizens while furthering the region's security and stability. The United States welcomes the understandings we reached on civil aviation yesterday. These exchanges address concerns important to U.S. aviation industry stakeholders and strengthen our economic cooperation. The President has made this matter a priority, and the outcome we achieved will ensure a level playing field in the global aviation market. I'm also pleased to announce that the U.S. and Qatari governments will sign a memorandum of understanding that creates a framework for the United States to provide technical assistance and training to the Qatari government on combating human trafficking. This MOU also provides for the creation of a bilateral government working group to discuss labor practices in Qatar. Through our continued cooperation, we hope to partner with Qatar to build institutional capacity to eliminate human trafficking, an area in which Qatar has already made significant strides. With respect to counterterrorism, following President Trump's challenge to all of our Gulf partners during the Riyadh summit last year, Qatar has made significant progress to improve efforts to combat terrorism. As a result of the Memorandum of Understanding our countries signed in July, the United States and Qatar have increased information sharing on terrorists and terrorist financiers. We have participated in counterterrorism technical training and taken steps to improve aviation security. We look forward to building on this foundation and implementing next steps. We will also discuss other critical regional security issues, including the ongoing battle to defeat ISIS, Daesh, the Gulf dispute, the situation in Syria, Iraq and Afghanistan, and Iran's role in the region. As the Gulf dispute nears the 8-month mark, the United States remains as concerned today as we were at its outset. This dispute has had direct negative consequences, economically and militarily, for those involved, as well as the United States. We are concerned by the rhetoric and propaganda employed in the region, playing out daily in Arab mainstream and social media. It is critical that all parties minimize rhetoric, exercise restraint to avoid further escalation, and work toward a resolution. A united GCC bolsters our effectiveness on many fronts, particularly on countering terrorism, defeating ISIS, and countering the spread of Iran's malign influence. The United States and Qatar will be signing three documents today outlining our cooperation in the important bilateral and regional areas mentioned, including three at this ceremony. The first is a memorandum of understanding that establishes the convention for this U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue on an annual basis going forward, so that we can continue to build on the close partnership between our two countries. The second document is a joint declaration outlining the United States' cooperation with Qatar on matters of shared regional and security interest. The third document is a memorandum of understanding that creates a framework for the cooperation between the United States and Qatar to combat human trafficking. I look forward to the outcomes of today's inaugural U.S.-Qatar strategic dialogue and our continued collaboration over the years to come. And with that, I'd welcome remarks from Foreign Minister Al-Thani.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Good morning, dear friend Secretary Tillerson, dear friend Secretary Mattis, Your Excellencies, member of the two delegations of the U.S.-Qatar Strategic Dialogue, ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted to express on behalf of the Qatari delegation our deepest gratitude for the warm welcome. This year, we are celebrating the 45th anniversary of the U.S.-Qatar Alliance. Our work today represents a milestone in a historically deep and continuous relationship between Qatar and the United States in defense, economic, education, and political unions. Holding this immensely significant first session of Qatar-U.S. strategic dialogue come as an expression and a celebration of the enduring and the close affiliation between our two countries. In a recent January phone call between the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and His Highness the Emir of Qatar, they have emphasized their mutual determination to strengthen the bilateral relation. A number of major agreements will be signed today covering defense, trade, investment, and energy, all areas where Qatar is committed to investing in America's economy. Qatar is already investing more than $100 billion in the U.S. economy, including $10 billion earmarked for infrastructure. Qatar and U.S. private sector have devoted substantial resources to the other. U.S. companies doing business in Qatar within construction, energy, and services industry. Qatari companies are investing in the U.S. financial services, healthcare, and technology markets. From Qatar hosting six prominent U.S. universities in our education city to Qatar investment in the LNG Golden Pass in Texas, our countries have shared interests that translate into job opportunities for the American and Qatari people. To make all these investments flourish, regional security is essential. So today, we will also discuss a range of security issues, including shared threats and further opportunities of regional cooperation. This joint endeavor takes place despite the difficult circumstances that Qatar currently faces. As a part of a larger regional crisis taking place in the Middle East, the state of Qatar and its people have been illegally and unjustifiably blockaded. This blockade disrupts the joint efforts in providing stability for the region. Let me express my profound gratitude for the effort of the President Trump, the U.S. Congress, and Secretaries Tillerson and Mattis and Mnuchin in taking a just position on the illegal activities of the blockading states throughout this Gulf crisis. We look forward to our continued cooperation on regional security to deliver long-lasting peace and security for the Middle East. In addition to security, both countries are committing to improving labor standards and joining forces to stop all forms of human trafficking. Qatar and U.S. are committed to delivering justice to our citizens. In closing, I reiterate my appreciation for your effort to ensure that this first round of the strategic dialogue will be held successfully. We look forward to hosting the second round in Doha next year. Our mutual goal is to deepen strategic bonds between our two countries and go forward together to yield the greatest mutual benefit. Thank you.
Excuse me, Secretary Tillerson, thank you for hosting this inaugural Qatar-United States security dialogue with our counterparts, Foreign Minister Al-Thani, and my friend, the Minister of State for Defense, Al-Attiyah. The United States enjoys a long-standing defense relationship with Qatar, a strong and valued military partner. Qatar is a longtime friend in the region. Even in the midst of its own current challenges, Qatar and the United States maintain excellent military-to-military relations. Hosting Al Udeid Air Base, home to our Combined Air Operations Center, United States Air Force Central Command Forward Headquarters, and U.S. Central Command's Forward Headquarters, providing critical counterterrorism support to the Defeat ISIS, Defeat Daesh Coalition, and President Trump's South Asia strategy. We are grateful to Qatar for their longstanding support of America's presence and continuing commitment to regional security, a commitment that includes information sharing and counterterrorism training. It should be noted that just this last week, the Qatari Air Force completed its first two C-17 flights from the Gulf to Afghanistan and back, providing logistical support to the NATO counterterrorism campaign in Afghanistan. As Secretary Tillerson stated, a United Gulf Cooperation Council bolsters our effectiveness on many fronts, particularly on countering terrorism, defeating ISIS-Daesh, and countering the spread of Iran's malign influence. It is thus critical that the GCC recovers its cohesion as the proud Gulf nations return to mutual support through a peaceful resolution that provides for enhanced regional stability and prosperity. I look forward to a lasting Qatar-U.S. security relationship, a relationship that will continue to bolster our efforts against common security threats and violent extremism. So thank you, and Minister Al-Attiyah.
Secretary Tillerson and General Mattis, thank you. Distinguished colleague, I reaffirm the remark raised by Sheikh Mohammed regarding our special relation with the U.S. Qatar and the United States have long enjoyed special relationship, a relationship built on a mutual respect and trust. We have stood together many times in the face of tyranny, fought those who defy the rule of law, and worked jointly to confront the complex and expensive challenges that face our region today. The relationship extends beyond the security, defense, and political. It extends in the educational, as Sheikh Mohammed said, energy sector, commerce, and social tie. I speak of the special relation that we share with our friend and allies here in the United States, and there is no better way to demonstrate the uniqueness of this relation than by looking at our military-to-military partnership. As some of you are acutely aware, Qatar and the United States have been strategic military allies for quite some time now. We have shared our friend burden and have carried on our own weight in the effort to bring peace, justice, and stability to our region and beyond. This inaugural meeting marks an important moment in our relationship with our friend here. In the U.S., we look forward to building on the existing infrastructure of our historic and strategic relationship through exploring a way in which we are able to expand our bilateral coordination and further our effort to in realizing our shared objective of peace, security, and prosperity for our nation and beyond. The State of Qatar has never wavered its commitment to stand with the friends and ally, especially when they need, when they needed us the most. When others in the region were no longer able to accommodate U.S. presence of their soil, Qatar eased restriction and expedited its offer to host its ally, Al Udeid Air Base, which currently hosts 11,000 of your brave men and women, has been at the epicenter of the global fight against terrorism. Qatar has spared no effort in increasing the readiness and efficiency of Al Udeid operation by investing billions of dollars in the direct infrastructure and maintenance of the strategic airbase. We are looking toward the future of our military partnership with the United States as we plan for the year ahead. Qatar and its trusted ally have reaffirmed their commitment toward the stability and prosperity of both nations. The recent purchase of the F-15s fighter jet single a new era of cooperation. This strategic bird will assure our readiness to protect our own border and aid our allies further in our collective fight toward peace and stability. Creation of tens of thousands of jobs, direct new jobs, and 10,000 more of indirect creation jobs. The initiative has been jointly constructed ensure, and I'm referring to the military initiative which we are looking to achieve in Qatar, and we call the 2041, has been jointly constructed to ensure the safety of the forces serving in Al Udeid and facilitate future capacity building by alleviating the classification of Al Udeid to permanent U.S. base. The cooperative initiative will include the exchange of military personnel and the expansion of Al Udeid Air Base and include on-base housing for the American service member and their families, new state-of-the-art schools, as well as building quality recreational entertainment and service facility. Qatar has demonstrated its commitment to well-being of the community of American service member in Al Udeid and their family, who serves alongside them by facilitating for needs. The initiative aimed to serve the needs of the community living in Al Udeid and ease their transition and assimilation. In the current Gulf conflict, the disruption of CT effort, destabilizing allied forces effort in the region. Brave men and women of Qatar, since our inception, there has been those who wished to impose their domain over us. Qatar did not waver then, and it will not waver now. And to protect the sovereignty and fight of its independence, the brave people of Qatar stood firmly with their leader in face of the mounting hostility directed toward their country. They refused to be manipulated or used as a pawn in an arbitrary and pointless conflict. We are here today to work for this men and women and for the men and women of your great country, to explore economic, social, military, and social opportunity that would progress our effort toward prosperity and stability. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
The Syrian National Dialogue Congress closed in Sochi, Russia on Tuesday. This was the Russian representative, Alexander Lavrentiev.
Thank you. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, Russia has done a lot to maintain Syrian statehood, territorial integrity. Over the last 2 years, since the beginning of the military operation in Syria, we have destroyed the hotbed of international terrorism in Syria. In this regard, Syria, jointly with other member states of the Astana process, realize that there's a need to step up political process, the political settlement process, and we made this initiative to host the Congress of Syrian National Dialogue. As you might recall, this initiative was supported at the meeting in December of the leaders of three countries, Russia, Iran, and Turkey. We did our best to put together a list of participants so that we can bring representatives of all walks of life, Syria under one roof, representatives of internal, external opposition, representatives of the government. This goal has been reached, as we can see, because 1,393 delegates attended this event, more than 50 observers, 34 international observers, 19 UN observers, and also we have observers from US, UK, who unfortunately were represented at a fairly low level. A lot of people were eager to participate as observers, but we had to decline their requests given their roles and the significance that they played in the Syrian settlement process. So the point I would like to make is that in the course of the entire Congress, we had a very business-like, constructive atmosphere. We're thankful to the delegates because they were really truly driven by their sense of responsibility, patriotism, and all in all, they managed to overcome their grievances, to put them aside today, and we did not really register any sharp polemics, debates between the opposition and the government representatives, and that's very important. People looked face to face, and that's why this Congress was called the Syrian National Dialogue Congress. So on the outcomes of the Congress, I'd like to say that three documents have been approved. The final statement, concluding statement, an address of the participants, and a list of nominees for the Constitutional Commission. Constitutional Commission, what we call it. This list will be submitted once it goes through another endorsement. It will be submitted to Stefan de Mistura, special UN envoy for Syria, for further work.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The release the memo moment is upon us. Republicans are billing it as some kind of silver bullet revealing political corruption at the highest levels of the Department of Justice and FBI. The Democrats, on the other hand, and their supporters in the liberal media call it a distraction. Finally, the public will decide. Crosstalking released the memo. I'm joined by my guest, Lee Stranahan in Washington. He's an investigative journalist and a co-host for Fault Lines on Radio Sputnik. Also in Washington, we have James Jatris. He's a former advisor to the U.S. Senate Republican leadership. And in Los Angeles, we cross to H.A. Goodman. He's a columnist and journalist published in the Huffington Post, Salam, The Hill, and other publications. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In effect, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. H.A., as usual, you got up earliest for this program. God bless you. Glad to have you with us. All right, we have our heads beginning to roll. We have Andrew McCabe out. Is Rod Rosenstein next, and who else? And talk about the state of denial in the liberal media. Go ahead, H.A. It's good to see you again.
It's great to be here. Well, the Obama White House illegally spied on Trump since 2015. This is according to The Guardian. GCHQ was sending information to the U.S. intelligence community about Trump associates. This is before the alleged Russian hacking of the DNC. This is before all the Facebook posts apparently gave swing states to Trump. And this is before the Russian hacking narrative. There is no crime that Trump is said to have committed. So they've been spying on Trump illegally. Susan Rice unmasked names illegally. And they tried to find information on Trump associates, even though Donald Trump has never been accused of a crime and he's not the subject of a crime. They haven't found any evidence, and it's been since 2015. The Mueller probe is completely partisan, and it was a result of James Comey's queasy memos.
Mm-hmm.
Russia never interfered in the election to the point of giving the election to anyone. What took place was it was a $1.2 billion loss from Hillary Clinton. And to cover up the loss, we know that there was an insurance policy. So Peter Strzok, in the text messages, stated, well, I spoke to Andrew McCabe, and now McCabe is out, and that we can't question whether or not we have to have an insurance policy if in the event that Trump wins. Then you have Peter Strzok.
Okay, all right, all right. H.A., you've covered a lot of material right there. Let me go to James here. I mean, H.A.'s got it down cold here, the facts here. But James, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we're going to actually see what's behind the curtain here, how the Obama Justice Department and FBI operated as they went through the election cycle here. This is the real scandal here, because if you look at all of these things, Peter Strzok and his girlfriend and all these things with Andy's office and all that, there's nothing about Russia there. Absolutely zip. Go ahead, James.
That's absolutely right. What we're really talking about, I think the key word here is conspiracy. There was a conspiracy within organs of the federal government, particularly the FBI. I understand there's some reference to the CIA in this memo as well. We'll have to see if it's in there or not. But I think if you look at the hysteria with which the Democrats have been opposing release of this memo, and also the distraction that the media has been pursuing to take away the attention from this memo. If you go to the three networks or MSNBC or CNN, they don't lead with talk about this memo. They talk about Trump once thought about firing Mueller. It's the Saturday Night Massacre all over again. It's an attempt to deflect from the real news, which is this thing, which I expect in short order, we will see what's what. And I do think some other heads will roll, not just McCabe's.
You know, that's interesting. You know, the non-news event is news. I mean, what kind of world are they living in? I know what kind of
exactly.
world.
Exactly.
They live in a very intellectually corrupt and moral world. That's what I think here. You know, Lee, you had Christopher Wray came out of his office and kind of wandered up, I guess it was to the Capitol, and he looked at this memo here. And reports say that he was surprised or shocked. I don't remember the exact word. Why in the world is the head of the FBI surprised about material that the DOA and the FBI gave to Congress? I have to wonder what's going on with the head of the FBI. If he is shocked, then we all are in a very worrisome place here. Go ahead, Lee.
Well, let's talk about the real problem here. The problem is not rogue agents. The problem is institutional. The problem is, I'll use the term deep state. You could also call it the persistent state. It is not a shock at all that the CIA is involved in this, because the fact is, whoever is in the White House, whoever is in Congress, there is a persistent group of people who stay from administration to administration. It's an unelected fourth branch of government, and that's what's happening. This is an institutional thing, and whatever you think of Donald Trump, whatever you think of his policies, I'm a Trump supporter, but if you don't like him, it doesn't make any difference. He was clearly an outsider who the deep state, the persistent state, was very, very worried about. And part of that apparatus is also the media. I cover a lot of White House press briefings. Let's flash back to last spring. Over and over and over again, I was in that room, in the White House press briefing room, when Trump came out and said that I was wiretapped. He said it. Remember that? The media acted as though he was a crazy person. And it was 5 days of questioning. And I remember every media outlet was tag-teaming each other. Hey, you ask this, I'll ask that. Now, cut to the last week. I was in three briefings last week at the White House. And I was there the first time a question was asked about releasing this memo. I had sat through a number of briefings. It had already been on social media, right? And it had already been out. By the way, why was it on social media? Because over 100 Republican congressmen looked at it. It's not Russian bots. When 100 Republican congressmen look at something and go, we think this should come out, it's going to resonate through particularly Republican social media.
Well, part of what's going on here is the media
needs to cover it up.
Well, yeah, because they're complicit. And H.A., I mean, and this is...
That's what I was going to say.
Watching MSNBC and CNN, and they're terrified of this memo. I mean, watching them go blue in the face, like, but what about national security? What about this? It's Trump's fault. I mean, they don't even want... I mean, I thought sunshine was the best cure here. I mean, that was an old liberal mantra, at least the way I was growing up, okay? I mean, they want to continue to live in darkness where they bring the public with them every single night. Go ahead, H.A.
Well, there's a reason why Fusion GPS and BuzzFeed are being sued by three Russian bankers, an entrepreneur, and I think Trump's lawyer is suing Fusion GPS. The Trump-Russia dossier was complete nonsense, and it was a fantasy. Maybe Bill Clinton's fantasy, who knows? But it was complete and utter nonsense. Gossip, hearsay, derived from Russian sources. So the collusion is actually the DNC and Hillary Clinton purchasing the dossier for about around $9 million in fees to the law firm that Clinton used. Congress should ask for an itemized report to find out how much was actually paid for this nonsense used for a FISA warrant. So that's what the hashtag released the memo. It's all about...
That's what we're going to find out.
It's all about gossip and hearsay being used to infringe on Trump's Fourth Amendment rights.
Let me go to James here. Remember when the quote-unquote Trump dossier, Russia dossier came out, how everybody wanted to shop it around after BuzzFeed let it go? Everybody wanted to shop it. Look at this. Look at that. Amazing, amazing. Of course, they were a bunch of fools. They didn't even know what they were reading. I read it and thought this is ridiculous from the get-go. But when it comes to a memo about information that the DOJ and the FBI have collated and made available to these investigations, these committees here, liberal media doesn't want to say a word about it, except for it will be a danger to national security. You know what? The liberal media is a danger to national security. Go ahead, James.
That's right. And that's why I'm reserving my let's say, excitement and celebration over the release of this memo when it comes, that it's going to be a silver bullet to shut this down. Yep. Yes, I think some of the cancer may be cut out of the bureaucracy and maybe some of it won't be. My concern is that it is fundamental purpose to make sure there could be no rapprochement with Moscow, that relations would stay very bad. Unfortunately, I think it's largely succeeded in that purpose.
Even people who are defending
Trump, referring to the Steele memo, for example, say, and it's full of Russian dirt and Putin's propaganda, and we have no way of knowing where this British spook got this, how reliable sources were, how much of this was just made up because they were getting paid. Your client wants dirt, we'll give you dirt.
But the
Russian bad narrative has been so entrenched now, I'm not sure how we get it out.
Yeah, that's good. Lee, that's interesting. That's a very interesting point, and I agree with him completely because the die has been cast on that element there, okay? It's across the board. If you question it, you're a bot. You're a useful idiot. But the interesting thing also, the other side, though, is that we see the level of corruption at the highest echelons of law enforcement. So you get the worst possible worlds here. Go ahead, Lee. Go ahead. Jump in.
Well, here's what it is. This is a disinformation operation against Russia. Period. That's what this is. And you can't have a disinformation operation by only going to one side. In other words, you've been talking about the liberal media. Again, I'm a Republican. I'm a Trump supporter, and I used to work as the lead investigative reporter for Breitbart. Let me say this. Breitbart has been just as bad on this issue. And the right conservative media, this is why I say this is a disinformation operation about Russia that succeeded not just because left media, the New York Times, Washington Post, MSNBC, and so on, but because the right media, with stories like the Uranium One story, for instance, which demonizes Russia, which I hate Hillary Clinton. That story's false. And you could see that when Bannon got in trouble, my former boss, Steve Bannon, got in trouble for saying it was that treasonous Trump Tower meeting, right? Steve admitted in his apology, his walk back, he hates Russia, too.
Okay, Lee.
So what you're having here is people on the left and right.
I'll let you keep going after our short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on that infamous memo. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Lee in Washington. I want to ask all three of you the same question here. I mean, the Mueller investigation goes on. With the release of this memo, does it nullify his investigation or, you know, lower in its importance here? There's going to be, depending on what it is, I mean, we've all heard a lot of different rumors, you know, little snippets here. I think we all have a pretty good idea what it is. And it would seem to negate the whole Russiagate narrative, even though, as James has pointed out on the program, the damage has already been done, okay? They can walk away from this and the damage is already done. So I'll go to Lee first. Does this nullify the Mueller investigation? Go ahead.
Well, it won't, and here's why. What they're talking about, the FISA stuff, happened before Mueller was on the investigation. But there's a wider point, though. This has not been about Russia election interference or Russian hacking forever. Mueller immediately went on a fishing expedition with Thing, and that is 100% clear. There is no attempt, for instance, if you're legitimately trying to find a collusion, right? You look for a quid pro quo. What did Trump offer? Where's the investigation into what Trump was getting back for this supposed election interference? In other words, that's what you'd have to do. Every prosecutor knows that, and Mueller knows that too. The reason he's going far afield, the reason, why would he interview even Steve Bannon, right? Why would he look into this one anti-Magnitsky Act corporation? The reason why is this is a disinformation campaign. One of the people who people on the left and right need to watch out for here is a guy, Bill Browder. Bill Browder has been pushing this anti-Russia narrative, and he is key to this whole thing. And he has fooled both the left and the right. And I got to say that.
Okay, but
everybody
Lee, you're absolutely right, but you're really broadening it out here, okay? I want to make sure people understand, because you have a deep knowledge of it, just like H.A. does, and James as well. H.A.,
yeah.
I mean, but maybe I should rephrase my question. What about the perception of the vitality of this investigation once we find out? All of the highest echelons of the FBI and the DOJ have weaponized their position against their political opposition, which I've said before and I'll say it again, turns the U.S. into a banana republic. Okay, go ahead, H.A.
What Trump must do, and I believe what he will do, is fire Mueller. And when the indignation is heard throughout the universe from CNN and MSNBC, all Trump needs to say is this: I fired Mueller because there's no evidence of any collusion or any criminal activity from me or any of my associates pertaining to the mission of the probe. Hillary Clinton, for example, actually committed crimes. She removed top secret and special access program intelligence, the highest level classification, from SIPRNet, JSCIF, secure government locations. She transferred them in a creative manner that nobody talks about from those locations onto her once unencrypted server. That is a crime under the Espionage Act. U.S. Code 793F. What Peter Strzok did is remove gross negligence five times, the references, which directly relates to the Espionage Act and that statute. You don't even need gross negligence because she paid Brian Pagliano $5,000.
But
the issue...
I don't think there's any way he fires Mueller, by the way.
No, but what you're doing, and I'm not overwhelmed that you went down this avenue, but it actually proves a point here. James, H.A. brings up this point. We have these two narratives out there, and depending on how you see politics is what you're going to stress. I agree, because Hillary Clinton was given a free pass over and over and over again. Donald Trump, like him or don't like him, there is no evidence that he committed a crime, not yet, after all this time. Okay, though the other side. And so you have CNN and MSNBC do not want to talk about the crimes of Hillary Clinton and her mafia gang, because that's essentially what they are. Okay, and all they can do is focus on me going to James here. All they can do is focus on the what they believe, what they hope, what they pray for are sins of Donald Trump. But in all those words I just used, it's not illegal. Go ahead, James.
I hope AJ is right that Mueller will be out. I think that means also getting rid of Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and possibly replacing Jeff Sessions with somebody who will actually do something about this stuff. But my concern is this, is that Mueller is Captain Ahab going after the great orange whale here. And even if he can't find a real crime, real collusion, just like with General Flynn and George Papadopoulos, you try to trap somebody into a process crime. That's why he's so keen to interview Trump personally and try to find some way to twist his words into either perjury or obstruction of justice. So even though there was no crime of collusion and there's no crime at all, you can get him to say, but in the process of the investigation, he did commit a crime. He committed perjury when he talked to me. And that's what they're really hoping to do. He wants to nail some more scalps to the wall to justify his existence.
I think at the end of the day, he's not going to do a one-on-one. I don't think his lawyers are going to let him do that. Okay, that's the typical bravado of Donald
Trump. And I don't think there's any way he fires Mueller.
Interesting point, because what I think is, again, when I talked about these battling narratives, let's just say, for example, okay, the memo is released at the end of the week. It will have an earthquake effect, okay? Who knows? Soon after, Mueller may give his assessment here. The problem is who's going to believe which narrative, okay? Because impeachment, as we all know, is not a legal process. It's a political process. So even if Mueller says Trump is guilty of this and it goes to the House of Representatives, if the other narrative is so much more compelling, then we get this gridlock. Uh-oh, we get the train crash, okay? Because even irrespective of what Mueller has to say, it may not have the political implications that he and the liberal elites and the media want. And that's going to be a very interesting parlay if it happens. Go ahead, Lee.
This is what I think the danger is. When I say this is a disinformation campaign, it's really important to understand this. All the narratives lead to Russia bad. That's what I'm saying. The Democrat narrative leads to Russia bad. We know that. That's clear. But the Republican narrative also leads to Russia bad. And that's the point. This has been a very successful disinformation campaign because the facts are actually not that difficult to determine. Anybody can look into this for themselves and learn the facts of this case. They can see what CrowdStrike did. They can see who Natalia Veselnitskaya, who's that Russian, well, let's just talk about that. She's that Russian lawyer. That's all you need to say. She's already been cast as like Natasha, right, in the Rocky and Bullwinkle, right? She's that Russian lawyer. And she is that Russian lawyer to both the left and the right. The right believe, this is what the right believes, because that's where I live. I live on the right. People on the right falsely believe that this was a setup, that she was put in there by the Clintons because she's connected to Fusion GPS, and we know Fusion GPS, blah, blah, blah. They don't even get what's going on there. And the left goes, oh, no, no, she's that Russian lawyer, so she's just bad. She was sent in by Putin. They all actually agree on it. And I think the good thing
people are starting to wake
up and figure this out on both sides.
Well, I hope so, but I don't have a lot of hope. This is an oasis, okay, right here on Crosstalk, okay, because we'll talk about all of the issues here. I don't have much hope for MSNBC. I watched Morning Joke and Meager today. I mean, what universe do they live in? I have no idea what they're talking about here. I think we all kind of agree that, you know, the die has been cast here. I mean, U.S.-Russia relations are for a generation done, okay? And actually, I don't really think about it much anymore, okay, because there's not much to be done about it. But what I think is really interesting here, and for me personally, it's not about Trump. It's not about Hillary. It's about the future of the republic institutions and the very idea of democracy. Bernie Sanders was burned, okay? It was stolen from him. We had the Clinton clan. They tried to steal the general, okay? And now they want, these same people, they want to overturn the democratic decision of the American people. And they don't care one hoot if they have to destroy everything in the process. Go ahead, H.A.
Well, this is all about, like you said, Democrats cheating Bernie Sanders, Debbie Wasserman Schultz being forced to step down, them losing $1.2 billion with a failed candidate who was under an actual criminal
investigation.
So in terms of competing narratives, there was evidence of crimes. She committed crimes, but Comey and Strzok and McCabe said she didn't intentionally commit the crimes. She was the subject of the investigation. With Trump, he's not the subject of any investigation. It's always this nebulous, ambiguous, oh, well, people around him, and there's a whole lot of smoke, but we can't prove anything. I think it's despicable that the Democratic Party chose to start a new Cold War because they couldn't rely on any policies.
Yep.
And they certainly couldn't rely on anything that Bernie Sanders stood for.
That's
so
part,
what they did is they cheated Bernie.
That's part of the destruction that I'm talking about, H.A., because, you know, the Democratic Party has shown itself for what it is, absolutely corrupt here. James, let me go to you. If Comey goes to jail, will you send him a file in a cake? I mean, will you feel sorry for Comey? Okay. Seriously. Because he forgave. You know, the irony is he made sure Hillary didn't go to jail. Because of that, he probably might go to jail. James, go ahead.
Please don't send him a cake.
No, I'm not going to send him a file in the cake or I won't send him anything. No. Look, obviously, there are a lot of people here who should go to jail. I have to tell you honestly, I am more concerned about the bigger picture. As has been pointed out by my two colleagues, this isn't just on the left that Russia bad, or it's the right as well. The damage is done, and I'm not complacent about it, because if you look at the way we're digging down deep into Syria, even though ISIS is on the ropes, we have no reason to be there. We should be declaring victory and getting out. Sure. We're arming lethal weapons to Ukraine. We're probing Russia's territorial waters with their aircraft. I'm afraid, you know, they keep talking about 1939, Putin on the march. This is more like 1914.
Okay, hang
and
on
my
here.
My fear is that
Jim,
something
me,
very, very bad could
here.
Happen if we
let
stumble
me,
into it.
Let me jump in here. Gentlemen, I want to make a quick statement to you and to our viewers. Robert Perry passed away a few days ago over at consortiumnews.com. Oh. A very courageous, very brave, very honest journalist. We're all going to miss him very much, very much. Condolences to his family. And I can tell you, there's no one in the world that will ever be able to replace the dignity of that man and his writing. So God bless to him and his family. And that's how we end our program. I want to thank my guests in Washington and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.